This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger. I'm Orion Samuelson saying good morning and welcome to the Saturday morning show here at 7 minutes past 5 o'clock. And again, working from our West Suburban studio in Huntley, Illinois today, where we're beginning to see a day brightener to the east and a temperature of 62 degrees in McHenry County this morning. A busy day ahead in a lot of different ways. You just heard the baseball schedule, and again, not very often that both Chicago teams are in town at the same time. It's been kind of an interesting week from that standpoint. And a lot of people to say good morning to this morning. A week ago tonight, I was in Racine, Wisconsin to speak at the 20-year club banquet of the company that builds tractors and combines and other farm equipment. Started out as McCormick Deering Farmall and then became International Harvester and then Case IH, now CNH after the get-together with New Holland several years ago. But they had about 600 people there, many of them retired, but people who had worked for the company for more than 20 years. A lot of WGN listeners at that CNH Veterans Group a week ago tonight. So good morning to you. And then good morning to several people at the Anvil Club in Dundee last night who came over to say, we listen to WGN all the time. And we appreciate that always. And it was nice to meet you and nice to visit with you. Mother's Day weekend, besides the Derby and all of the other stuff going on, so I thought we'd devote the first half of the program this morning to visiting with ladies. And Max Armstrong, as a matter of fact, will be talking to the 2016 National Farm Mom of the Year. That lady introduced for the first time on Friday. So all of that is coming up. And before we get to the Farm Mom of the Year, I want you to meet a young lady who, in all my years of covering agricultural trade agreements and agricultural trade, probably has shown me more knowledge of what goes on in those negotiations and trading community than, golly, a lot of people who have spent a lifetime doing it. But anyway, we'll get to all of that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. 13 minutes after 5 on this Saturday morning, a little dampness in the area this morning and probably continuing throughout the day. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement is right now in the critical stage of having to be approved by the 12 countries that are involved in that trade agreement, ranging from Southeast Asia up the Pacific, down the Pacific to Chile and South America. It is an important trade agreement for what is certainly a global community. The U.S. trade negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative's office is a young farm lady from Nebraska. And I'll tell you, every time I talk to this lady, I come away impressed. And so when I recently had the chance to sit down with Darcy Vetter, I asked her to talk about the importance of the current agreement.
TPP is the highest standard trade agreement ever negotiated. It's 12 countries in the Asia Pacific, many of whom we already have free trade agreements with, so we have a path to get to zero tariffs. But through TPP, we have raised the standards in those trade agreements. Take, for example, NAFTA with Mexico and Canada, where most of our tariffs are already at zero. But when we negotiated NAFTA 20-plus years ago, We didn't put, at that time, labor and environment standards inside the agreement. We didn't have strong commitments to certain IP protections or to a free and open internet. We didn't have an internet to make sure it was free and open. So we've really been able to upgrade existing FTAs, but we also create new market access and those high standard rules with some very important new economies in the region as well. That includes Japan, an extremely high-value, high-income country where we can send some of our highest quality products. Japan has a notoriously difficult to navigate ag sector. And in all of its past FTAs, it just kept a number of agricultural products off the table. It said, we just won't negotiate with you on rice, on wheat, on pork, beef, dairy. Those are our sacred products, and we're not going to include them. For the first time ever in a free trade agreement, because of the value of these 12 countries all coming together, all of those products are on the table. Every product from every country in TPP without exclusion and is, or without exception, is liberalized in some way. Same is true if you look at Vietnam and Malaysia. Now, here are emerging economies that have put their products on the table, eliminating tariffs for our exports. Those countries right now are very good customers for things like our primary products, our corn, our soybeans, our skim milk powder. But their populations are rapidly growing, and the percentage of their population that's joining the middle class is rising rapidly as well. So think about Vietnam, 90 million people in that country alone, and we expect the volume, the value, and the variety of what they import to change greatly, because as those individuals join the middle class, they change what they eat. They want more proteins in their diet. They want more fresh fruits and vegetables, the quality and the nutrition of what they consume. And so we see huge opportunities in those countries across the spectrum of our agricultural producers. And we have the highest standard rules ever in TPP, and that includes things like sanitary and phytosanitary standards. For those of you who've been tracking these ag markets, you know that sometimes when tariffs go down, SPS barriers go up. All of you probably have covered the barriers to our beef exports after the detection of a BSE case. Well, in the beginning, what started as an animal health measure became a sticky measure that was more about protecting other countries' beef industries from U.S. imports. And so the TPP contains the highest standard rules ever on SPS, requiring that countries demonstrate that both there is an underlying risk, a scientific basis for taking an animal, plant health, or food safety measure, but also that the specific measure itself is based on science and is least trade restrictive necessary, so that it covers the risk, but it doesn't go beyond that to act in a way that discriminates against foreign imports. It also creates new standards for transparency, not just in the SPS chapter, but across the different chapters of the agreement. Now, sometimes our exporters don't know what conditions they'll face when their product hits a border. This would require advanced publication, notice and comment in rulemaking, clear explanation of the testing procedures, the conditions that our products would face at the border, and then time to comment on those regulations before they go in force, being able to make recommendations of ways they could do it. That accomplishes the risk mitigation, but might be less trade restrictive for foreign product. And for the first time ever, those SPS provisions are subject to dispute settlement in an FTA. In our past bilateral or regional free trade agreements, we used to just recognize the SPS commitments we had at the WTO and say, take your disputes there. But since we increased the obligations, we want more intensive engagement on SPS issues, we've included dispute settlement in this agreement as well. And then last, I would say this agreement presents an opportunity not just for the 12, but for the whole region, and an opportunity to open and integrate our markets through the Asia Pacific, but also the normative value of taking those high standards, those commitments to transparency and science-based decision making, and spread them throughout the Asia Pacific. When we launched the TPP, we made a strategic decision to take 12 countries who were willing to put every product on the table, to negotiate the highest standard rules possible, and to make them the core, with the intention that once that core was active, once TPP is passed and enforced, other countries would be welcome to join. We would be the magnet for the region. And within 1 week of the conclusion of our negotiations in October, 8 countries had called Ambassador Froman, our trade representative, to say, when are you taking new entrants?
Darcy Vetter, agricultural trade negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, who sat before farm broadcasters in Washington, D.C. without a note in front of her detailing the TPP importance. I just hope our presidential candidates were listening. I don't think they have a clue how important trade and agricultural trade is, listening to their comments in the campaign. Interestingly enough, when she was Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton supported this trade agreement. Now that she's running for president, she doesn't. And I would guess that's because of votes. It is 20 minutes after 5 coming up, the Farm Mom of the Year, when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show. There were 5 regional moms of the year selected early in the process, and then for the past couple of weeks, all of us had an opportunity to vote on the 2016 Farm Mom of the Year. And this week, a couple of days ago, they announced the winner, and Max Armstrong was there to say hello to her. Good morning, Max.
The voting was completed this week, Orion, as folks voted for Farm Mom of America in that annual recognition program sponsored by Monsanto. And the choice that was made was to name as National Farm Mom Mary Courtney, a Kentucky farmer. She and her husband farm just a little bit east of Louisville, Kentucky, in Shelby County, Kentucky. And one interesting thing she pointed out to me when we visited a couple of weeks ago, she and her husband, didn't have much help getting started.
Well, my husband and I started from scratch, and that's probably a very key component of our farm because we both grew up in families that farmed, but we just had this drive to do it. And so we both had public jobs, and we said, you know, if we're going to do it, this is the time. And so with a newborn in tote, we started raising 27 acres of burley tobacco. Tobacco was a stable cash crop in Kentucky. Within a year, though, we realized if we were going to stay farmers, we had to diversify. So we started working with some adjoining farmers, and they helped us kind of custom raise some grain, and that also helped with crop rotation. And then we started out with just 45 acres, which is a very small piece of land to full-time farm on. So it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. An adjoining landowner said, I'm going to sell my 50 acres. We like what you all are doing. We want to offer it to you before we put it out on the market. We weren't ready to buy a piece of property, but we had to. We had to figure out how to work, make it work. And so we're nestled between Louisville and Lexington. And local foods made sense to us to bring that into our operation. And we realized that if we could meet the needs of the consumer, then that would in turn meet our needs and wants as farmers to be able to create this business, to be able to be here for the long haul. So at that time, we had a lot at risk, and we still do, but our vegetable operation has expanded, our grain operation has expanded, our tobacco has expanded, but it, at the same time regressed some. So and then we were able to bring in livestock to our operation. In the midst of this, so from 2008 to now, we have 4 children. And they are the reason we do what we do. They're the reason that we continue to expand, the reason that we want to continue finding more ways to diversify, to protect our farm. It's a lifestyle that we want them to learn the value of hard work and reward, the morals and values that we can help instill for them. It's a sense of stewardship for us to be able to make our work be a prosperity for other people. And so there's all kinds of reasons that we do what we do. And I think we're able to be successful because we had that drive of starting from scratch. Every year brings its own challenges, whether it's the markets, the weather, somebody not paying you and figuring out how to overcome that, whatever it may be. We just keep going, and it's because of that big why we're doing what we're doing. And we can accomplish what we want by helping others get what they want, and that's what kind of has been an underlying foundation for us.
I know you like to share the story of your farm, the agriculture story. What's your favorite way of doing that, where you feel like you really make a difference?
We bring people to the farm. We don't do it as part of agritourism. necessarily as far as for the income, but my husband and I feel like it's very important to teach through experience. So towards the end of our produce season, we invite the public. Originally, it started out just as our customers. Now we open it up to anybody and everybody. And you come to a working farm for a day. Do we have lush restroom facilities or, you know, the finest of this and that? No. But they get to come and really, they can pick vegetables at their end of their season. And we may watch a child think they don't like peppers, but then they take a bite of it. And before you know it, they're walking around and they've pulled up the bottom of their shirt and they're filling it up with peppers. It's just amazing to watch them learn and appreciate what we do on a daily basis. You know, one year we had a flat tire on our wagon that we were doing a hayride on, and we got a note about what an experience that was for a parent to watch their child learn about something happening when it's not planned and them figuring out what to do with it and realizing that farming is not easy. And you have to be, you know, an engineer at heart and figure things out. So, but bringing people to our farm has been probably the most rewarding. We feel like we're truly changing lives that way. And it all comes back to the one-on-one conversations and the one-on-one personal attention that we can give those individuals when they're at our farm for our Touch the Dirt Day. That's what we call it, just to get people to realize the simplicity in raising food.
Mary Courtney, she and her husband started farming just 8 years ago in Shelby County, Kentucky. She's the National Farm Mom of the Year. And as you can hear there, Orion, she's not only passionate about the business of farming, but about telling the story. And I agree with her. That one-on-one contact is so effective. I think that's the way to win hearts and minds as you visit with consumers to explain what's going on in the farming enterprise. That's our report on the Farm Mom of the Year. Big O?
All right, and let's once again mention the other four of the five regional finalists, because all of them had great stories. Ann Stamp of Rhode Island, Karen Casper of Owatonna, Minnesota, Katie Hager of Underwood, North Dakota, and Nikki Weathers of Yuma, Colorado. Ladies play such an important role in not only raising the family and taking care of that side of the picture, but being involved in the economics and the bookwork and the fieldwork and everything else that goes on the modern farm today. Saturday morning, ahead of Mother's Day, Kentucky Derby Day, the Arlington Park Racecourse opened yesterday, and it'll be a derby party there today. And probably a little cooler weather and maybe a light shower or two showing up. But daybreak in McHenry County looking pretty good right now. And at 25 minutes before 6 o'clock on this Saturday morning with daybreak over the Midwest, we're back with part two of the Saturday morning show. And we begin, as we do every week, with Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. Today, we take a look at how much longer we can cover prime farmland. Talk about that in a moment. But if you're tired of your clothing being ruined by a spill or a stain, well, you don't have to put up with that. There's hope thanks to Wink Wash Away Laundry Stain Remover. This easy and safe to use pre-wash stain remover is a must-have in the laundry room for all washable, color-fast fabrics, including wool, cotton, synthetics, even cashmere. And for those unexpected stains when you're on the go, on the road, watch them vanish with Wink Instant Spot Remover. Check them out. Check out all of the fine Wink products at wink.com. WHINK.com. Now, Samuelson says, I am often asked, do you read your emails? Do you read your regular mail? And my answer to both questions is yes, but not always immediately. It takes time to get to the volume of emails that I receive every day. But I get story ideas from you via email, and that's the reason I'm discussing this week's topic. It's a local issue, but it could happen anywhere in the country. And I paraphrase the email from a farmer who said, I hear you say we're adding 2 billion people to the planet by 2050. I hear you say we need to feed them. I hear you say we don't have any new farmland, so we're going to have to feed them with technology. And the answer to all of those questions is yes. But then he goes on to say, what about covering productive farmland such as we're seeing in northern Illinois, northern Indiana, southern Wisconsin? The story revolves around the railroad that would like to move freight through the Chicago area but outside the city. And drivers in the city of Chicago would like to get rid of railroad crossings. And so they're proposing a 275-mile rail line that would cut through farms in northern Indiana, northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin. And once you cover them with a railroad track and a railroad yard, you're not going to get that productive farmland back. I realize we are living in a far different time than a century ago when we needed land for roads and railroads and schools and parks, and eminent domain played an important role in getting the land to do that. But now, with the increased population and the increased movement, it's getting more difficult. And if they run that 275-mile track through some of the prime farmland, oh, and they're talking about a 15,000-acre freight yard just south of Chicago, they will cover farmland that we will never, ever get back. I can understand both sides of this issue. But I'm beginning to think, with population growth on the planet and the need to feed that population, we're going to have to stop covering productive farmland pretty soon, or we can't feed the world. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks, and we're coming up to 20 minutes before 6 o'clock, and we'll talk markets. Been a very unusual spring in South America, and we have just the man to talk about that, Dr. Mike Cordonnier of SoybeansAndCorn.com, and we'll get to him when we continue on the Saturday morning show. It is always a pleasure to have Dr. Michael Cordonnier join us here in the studio to talk markets. And incidentally, you can find him on the internet at soybeansandcorn.com, soybeansandcorn, one word, .com. Dr. Mike, welcome back. And have we ever seen a more unusual spring for South America?
Well, it's always glad to be here, Orion. But usually April, we're talking about U.S. crops, but we had big surprises in South America. First of all, very severe flooding in Argentina. Argentina had a record soybean crop on the way until April 1st. And basically, they had 3 weeks of constant rain, 100% relative humidity, high temperatures, 80, 85 degrees, and flooded a lot of fields. And a lot of fields that weren't flooded, the soybeans were severely impacted by very poor quality of the beans. And in fact, the Buenos Aires Grain Exchange just now estimated that about 780,000 hectares of soybeans were completely flooded out, and another 700,000 was impacted. Now, that's about 7% of the total production in Argentina. So now everybody's estimates are coming down in Argentina.
And then Brazil has just the opposite in weather.
Brazil was just too dry. The soybean crop ended up very disappointing in Brazil. Now it's just barely bigger than last year's soybean crop in Brazil. And now the dry weather is impacting the second crop of corn. And that is two-thirds of all of Brazil's corn. And as you know, Brazil is now a big corn exporter, our number one competitor for corn exports. So what happens to that second crop of corn is really important in Brazil. And it's getting smaller day by day.
So when the numbers on planting intentions came out here in March, everybody was shocked. The markets went down, but they've come back. Is it because of South America?
I think it's all because of South America. Now, the fundamentals are still kind of a negative for the market. We got a big supply, but everybody's worried about La Nina coming in this summer. Could impact our yields for the U.S. And the money flow just went to commodities. Commodities all of a sudden look a much better prospect than equities. So a lot of fund money came into the market.
So are you expecting a big surprise when we get the planted acreage report in June?
Well, I thought 93.6 million acres of corn was too high, but now I'm not so sure. We have about 1 or 2 million less acres of prevent plant. Now, the last 2 years have been very wet, so we had a lot of prevent plant. That's not the case this year. So there your pie got a little bit bigger by 1 or 2 million acres. So I would say corn acreage 93 to 93.6, and then my soybean area is 83 to 83.5. So those numbers looked big in March, but now they look pretty good.
So with the problems in South America and possible problems here always, what is happening to the stocks numbers coming down?
I think they will come down. Now, we're still going to have a comfortable supply, but there's one big change in soybeans. You know, the market keeps anticipating a record crop year after year out of South America. Well, now with the problems in Argentina and Brazil, the South American soybean crop this year is going to be smaller than last year. First time in like 4 years. And now the next crop in South America could be even smaller for soybeans because Brazilian farmers are going to plant more full season corn. Corn prices are really good in Brazil. Argentine farmers are going to plant more corn because the government policy change favors corn. So all of a sudden, we go from this record crop every year after year in South America. Now it's not a record anymore. So now all of a sudden, if we would have a short soybean crop in the United States, that comfortable supply is gone.
We tend to see concern about the transportation situation in Brazil and in Argentina. Is that improving? Is it getting better?
Brazil is slowly improving. They, of course, have a very, very bad economic situation right now, so things have kind of slowed down a little bit. But there's more soybeans moving north to these northern ARCA ports, and I think that's a big deal in Brazil. They're building new ports on the Amazon, deep water ports in the northeastern part of the state, northeastern part of the country. So there's more and more beans moving north. And I would say within 10 years, half of all of Brazil's soybeans will go out in northern ports instead of southeastern Brazil, you know, Paranaguá and Santos. So that's sort of a big deal. Now, it should have gone faster, but the economic situation has sort of slowed down the progress.
I had one listener email me asking, will the Panama Canal addition widening have an impact on our exports from the U.S.?
I think so, sure, absolutely. Yes, there's going to be more volume going through there. In fact, that was part of the impetus behind these ports in the northern part of Brazil, on the Amazon and northeastern Brazil. You know, you cut off like 3,000 kilometers. And yes, that will have a big impact, I think, on shipping through the Panama area.
And we can't talk grain or soybeans without talking China. Has the change in corn policy in China had an impact?
Yes. They were stockpiling a lot of corn, and they were paying a very high price for Chinese farmers to sell corn to the government. The government decided that's not the policy they want to pursue anymore, so trying to draw down on those stocks. But the problem in China is you never know how much is in stocks. It's in a couple of sacks in a guy's back room, so you don't know. And what's the condition of that corn? So a lot of people are a little bit suspicious that they have that many million tons of stored corn that's in good condition.
And then the GMO issue. That's still a part of our foreign trade, isn't it?
Yes, of course. It was just recently announced, I think it was Bunge and Cargill said they wouldn't take some Monsanto hybrids. It's an ongoing concern that just not going to go away anytime soon.
So as you hear from your clients on soybeansandcorn.com, what kind of advice are you giving now on what they should be doing, if anything, in the marketplace?
Well, I think the market's going to slowly move higher. It's not going to bolt higher unless we have a weather concern in the United States. Now, if we do have a weather concern, then it's going to be some very good markets this summer. But see, the problem is the timing of La Nina. It is coming a little bit sooner than anticipated, but it's going to be like June, July, and August. So we don't know if it's going to have an impact in the U.S. or not. But I tell everybody it will have an impact on South America. And in South America, La Nina gives you generally below trend line yields. in both Brazil and Argentina. So it may or may not impact U.S., but it will impact South America. And South America is by far the bigger soybean producer. They make the soybean market. So La Nina would have a big impact down there, which would impact our markets, of course.
Dr. Mike, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And you'll find Dr. Mike Cordonnier on his website, which is soybeansandcorn.com. Over the years, it's always interesting to get to know personally some of our interview guests. And I've known Dr. Mike Cordonnier for a decade or more, and we turn to him for his knowledge of South American agriculture. But I learned a little more this week when we sat down. I didn't realize that 45 years ago, Mike made his first visit to Brazil as a Peace Corps volunteer. And during that visit, worked with some local farmers with a new plant called soybeans. So I'm now crediting or blaming Dr. Mike with bringing soybeans to South America. He went on to marry a Brazilian lady and have a home in Brazil, and they still go back and forth for family reasons probably a couple times a year. But a very knowledgeable man on the biggest competitor to our corn and soybean crops, Brazil. This week, five distinguished agricultural professionals were selected to receive the prestigious Torch of Leadership Award from the Alumni Association of the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation. I've been involved in the work of that organization since it started back in the 1980s, and I'm proud to be a member of the Torch of Leadership. This week, they named the current group Martin Andreas, Solon, Iowa, Eldon Gould, Maple Park, Illinois, Donna Riefschneider, Smithton, Illinois, Robert Easter, Muhammad, Illinois, and Philip Nelson, Seneca, Illinois. I know them all, have worked with them over the years, and want to offer congratulations to the five who will be honored in Normal, Illinois at a special banquet on August 27. Now, the sad part of this announcement. On Monday, Marty Andreas passed away. Agriculture, particularly the corn industry and the ethanol industry, lost a strong supporter. Many of us lost a personal friend. Because Marty made an enormous impact on the corn industry in the United States. He started as executive vice president of corn sweeteners in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And Marty served as the president of ADM's corn division, later held many executive positions within ADM, including director of corporate marketing and senior advisor to the chief executive. Was a major force in new product development for the corn industry with his focus primarily on ethanol. How many times did we have Marty on the air, going back to the days when we called it gasohol? And it has now grown into a very important industry that manufactures for vehicles in the U.S., but has also become part of the export markets. Outside of that, Marty led the effort to secure the Farm Progress Show in Illinois, because now the Farm Progress Show is held every other year on a permanent site in Decatur. Marty was a mover and shaker in that one as well. No funeral or memorial service. There will be a celebration of life later at a date to be announced. But to his widow, Lisa, and to his family, we say thank you for the fact that he was such a strong leader. Now, the others being honored with the Torch of Leadership by the Illinois Ag Leadership Foundation, the alumni, Eldon Gould, lifelong Illinois grain and livestock producer, currently a partner in a 6,500-acre crop operation, as well as an owner of a 750-sow farrow-to-wean swine operation. He's held a variety of leadership roles for agriculture. And then they named Robert Bob Easter, President Emeritus at the University of Illinois, presently serving as chairman of Farm Illinois. Phil Nelson, another longtime friend, operating a fourth-generation grain and livestock farm near Seneca, with his family growing corn, soybeans, and alfalfa. In addition to a cow-calf operation, he received the award as State FFA Star Farmer in Illinois and later selected the American Farm Bureau Federation's National Outstanding Young Farmer. And then there is Donna Riefschneider, part of a family grain farm near Belleville, Illinois, and what a leadership role she has played in agriculture, serving on the executive committee of the U.S. Meat Export Federation and as president of the National Pork Producers Council. So, indeed, some outstanding people. Welcome to the family, and you raised the level of the award with your entry into the Torch of Leadership program. So as we near the 6 o'clock news, a quick look at yesterday's grain trade. It was an unusual day yesterday because we saw a sharp drop in price on Thursday. That brought funds and bargain hunters into the grain market yesterday. And as a result, May soybeans gained 26 and a quarter cents a bushel to end at 10.26 and a quarter. May corn up 4 and a quarter cents at 3.75 a bushel. May wheat didn't do quite as well, gained only half a cent yesterday to 4.53 and a quarter cents a bushel. And I'm getting requests now to do the new crop futures prices. December corn, which is new crop, yesterday up 3 cents, closed at $3.84 and three quarter cents a bushel. And the November soybean contract ended the week at $10.22 a bushel after gaining 22 and three quarter cents yesterday. No question that funds are a factor again in the grain market at the Chicago Board of Trade. That's our time for this morning, and we always appreciate your company. Max Armstrong and I'm Orion Samuelson, joining you every week between 5 and 6 a.m. on the Saturday Morning Show.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on the Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.